Florida, the capital of gambling, and outdoor jazz returns to South Florida. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governor DeSantis is pushing for a multi-billion dollar gambling deal with the Seminole Tribe. It could make Florida a big player in the world of casino games and sports betting. What could derail the plan, though? Also, there's a push for police reform in Florida and nationwide in the wake of the death of George Floyd. We'll hear from a constitutional law professor about how the Chauvin verdict could make that happen. Finally,
I just feel really privileged to share the stage with such incredible musicians.
Outdoor jazz is back in South Florida as more people get vaccinated. We'll hear from one of the performers at the upcoming Bayfront Jazz Festival. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. I want you to imagine a Floridian gambler's dream. Craps, roulette, sports betting, and you don't have to get on a plane. You could stay in South Florida and Vegas comes to you. Well, a new deal between the state and the Seminole Tribe aims to do just that. Governor Ron DeSantis signed the agreement last week. It's a historic achievement for both parties, but not so fast. It still has to go through some hurdles before it can take effect, and it's receiving pushback from gambling opponents. Joining us now is Mary Ellen Claus. She is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure.
Good to be here.
And by the way, we just want to mention that we reached out to the Seminole Tribe to be part of the program today. They did not reply to our request immediately. The offer still stands, though, for a later date. We'd love to hear from them. So, Mary Ellen, what changes exactly could we expect to see as a result of this gambling deal if it goes down?
Well, it's a pretty comprehensive step into some new territory. And the biggest thing is that it would bring mobile sports betting to Florida. That is the opportunity for people to stay at home and bet on a sports team. All of the transactions would go through the Seminole Tribe under this deal. And sports teams could benefit by offering it at their stadiums, and paramutuals could benefit by putting their brand on the mobile sports betting app, and then getting a cut of the pie. So that's the biggest change. And then there's also allowing the tribe to go to full Las Vegas style casinos, which would mean they'd add craps and roulette. And then if there's other provisions attached to this compact, there would also be the opportunity for the paramutuals to no longer be required to operate live races in order to keep their poker games or their slot machines. So that changes the framework of how gambling operates in the state. It moves us a little bit closer to where other states are with some of the innovations that have been happening. And it offers the opportunity for lots of new money.
And that's, yeah. So all these different groups will benefit, and that's the other aspect I wanted to ask you is, of course, what does the state get out of this? What do we get?
Well, for one thing, the state gets a 30-year deal with the tribe, which would guarantee $500 million a year in cash, unless it's renegotiated. And that is, because it's sports betting, because the Seminole Tribe would be the monopoly owner of the sports betting books, that amount is expected to grow. And so in the first decade, there's a prediction that it would bring Florida about $6 billion. And that's a pretty big chunk of money. It also means that there could be development around some of these existing paramutual facilities, and certainly development by the tribe. The tribe would get two new full casinos at their properties at their existing sites. So it wouldn't bring it into new places, but they're talking about Tampa, the Immokalee site in the Glades, and then the site near Hollywood South Florida.
So this deal was agreed upon and signed by the governor, but it still has to go through quite a few hurdles and the legislature. What has to happen next?
So the because the governor cannot sign off on a compact and have it be take force, it has to be ratified by the legislature. So the leadership has tentatively, well, they've scheduled, we haven't heard how long it's going to last, but they've scheduled a special session for them to come back and just take up a gaming legislation for May 17th. So they've got to ratify the compact. And then if there's going to be anything they do to help the paramutuals, they've got to pass separate bills related to that. One of the other things that has been discussed for almost a decade is updating Florida's regulatory structure. And this legislature is finally going to put that on in front of legislators and try and pass a gaming control commission, which would consolidate all the regulatory authority that's now dispersed from the state to counties to the attorney general's office and put it all in one place.
All right. What's the resistance? Obviously, there are those who are against expansion of gambling in the state of Florida, but what are they saying and what are they going to try to do?
Well, there's the biggest concern is what the tribe compact allows paramutuals to do. And so because the tribe gets to control what its competition looks like, they get to say whether or not they are okay with expanded gambling somewhere else. So the number one concern in South Florida, of course, is there going to be an additional casino or it in Miami-Dade, for example? There's talk of, you know, somebody selling a license and maybe selling it to Donald Trump or, you know, somebody who might buy out Donald Trump. And there's also concern about Jeffrey Sofer moving one of his two gaming licenses from the Big Easy Casino in Broward to Miami Beach. That would require legislation, and the opponents are really concerned about that. And then the third biggest concern is among the people that financed and backed the No Casinos effort in 2018, where voters said if there's any expansion of gambling in Florida, it has to go to a statewide vote. And the question now is, will what is passed constitute expansion? The proponents of that amendment say, yes, sports betting would be an expansion of gambling, and it would violate the compact unless it's authorized by voters statewide. And either way, there's going to be a lawsuit.
Yeah, and we talk about sports betting too, by the way. I mean, that's now allowed federally?
No. It's a little bit like the medical marijuana situation we're in. It's not allowed federally, but it's allowed. A Supreme Court ruling in 2016 allowed states to do mobile sports betting within the state. So right. That's what's been allowed.
I'm talking with Mary Ellen Claus, Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times, talking about Florida's new gambling deal with the Seminole Tribe. It would bring sports betting and allow for Las Vegas-style casinos at tribal facilities. You can find more of her reporting on this session and on this deal at our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, Mary Ellen, I want to turn over to a couple of other bills that legislators are moving on quickly as the session is about to end. One is a bill that would make it more difficult for social media platforms to punish users for violating the terms of service agreements. What exactly does the bill aim to change?
Well, right now, companies such as Facebook and Twitter and many of the companies that Amazon offers as a platform are allowed to, monitor what people write and censor that. And that was a big concern during the campaign. And so this bill would require that any social media company that wants to censor or remove a user from their social media site would have to give somebody 30 days notice. And so, and that's regardless of how dangerous your content is or how mild your content is.
And all of this,
30 days notice.
all of this goes back to it. The governor has been upset about how Twitter treated Donald Trump by throwing him off. Facebook threw Donald Trump off as well.
Yeah, after the insurrection, he was removed, and that angered a lot of supporters of the former president. But there are also many other people who have indicated that they have been removed without warning. And there's a lot of there seems to be within the supporters of this bill a lot of anecdotes that this has happened to people.
But does a state bill have the power to dictate to Facebook or Twitter, you know what you could do, what you're allowed to do with your platform?
Well, that is what is likely to be challenged. This mm-hmm. is yet another bill that will that is very likely to face litigation, because existing federal law, there have been numerous U.S. Supreme Court rulings that say that private businesses have the right to monitor the what they want to do. They can control who they want to offer their business to. And if you violate the terms of agreement in the mind of Facebook, they have a right to kick you off their platform. Now, what Florida's law would do is impose a notice warning on them and then fine them if they violate that. And that still is, the question remains, can a state force a company to do something that is a private business, and private businesses have the right to the First Amendment protections of the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah. I wanted to move over to another very contentious bill. It would impact vote by mail by requiring voters to present ID when leaving a vote by mail ballot in a drop box. This move has received a lot of criticism from advocates who say it would make voting more difficult, and from election supervisors saying that it would lead to longer lines. Where does this stand right now? What's expected to happen?
Well, we're in the final 2 days of the legislative session. They're in the midst of filing yet another amendment to rewrite provisions of this bill. It's been bounced back and forth between the House and the Senate already a couple of times, and I know that it's expected to come up again today, and we'll see if they can manage to negotiate enough changes to it to make it acceptable to the majorities in both chambers. The interesting issue is that is another bill that is expected to be immediately challenged. You talk about showing ID when you go to a drop-off box. That is perceived by many of the opponents as an attempt to suppress people dropping off their ballots or using vote by mail, because if you put your ballot in the post office box, nobody's asking you for ID then. So there are just many questions that are arising with some of these new provisions, and it's going to be a little bit of I think before we see the end of this debate.
Yeah. What's your sense about how some lawmakers have been passing their agenda throughout this session? I mean, we've seen a number of bills that we thought were dead, and then they got pushed the last minute. This happens the last few days, right? You'll hear about these zombie bills, and then people are just trying to shove their ideas in somewhere else just to be able to give it some life. I mean, has that worked out?
So we have the results of elections matter, and Republicans have a dominant majority. They have a compliant governor, and everyone is kind of on the same page with this agenda. So there have been several bills that had never gotten a hearing that have been rolled into other bills as they moved. As you mentioned, some bills that appeared to be in trouble have been resurrected, two very controversial ones, one to overturn the vote of Key West voters on their cruise ship limitation, and another to ban transgender school kids from participating in sports. Those are both bills that looked like they were in trouble earlier this week. And then yesterday they got resurrected and pushed through against the wishes of Democrats. And now they're on the governor's desk. I do think that they've been a little bit more ostentatious about this. And it's been interesting to watch. They don't care. They obviously are not worried about the consequences of their just shoving things through like this. And, you know, maybe it's because there will be none, but it's definitely pretty blatant this year, especially.
Mm. And again, you were talking about with the transgender athletes and keeping transgender athletes from participating in women's sports. Again, I want to thank Mary Ellen Kloss. She is the Tallahassee Bureau Chief of the Miami Herald and the Tampa Bay Times. Follow all of her reporting on this session. Again, the session's almost over, but you can find her work on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Mary Ellen, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis. Take care.
All right, still to come. President Biden has ambitious plans for criminal justice reform. Will it make a difference in holding police accountable? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. President Joe Biden addressed Congress and the nation last night following his first 100 days in office. One of the biggest issues facing his presidency has been police accountability. He called on Congress to pass the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act by the end of May. The act would limit qualified immunity as a defense and would lower the criminal intent standard in cases where a police officer is charged with misconduct. On the state level, there's a bill in Tallahassee that would set use of force standards for police officers. Donald M. Jones is a constitutional law professor at the University of Miami. He's been following criminal justice reform issues for decades. Donald, great to have you back on the program.
Great to be here.
Thank you so much. Donald, how significant are the proposed changes on the state and federal level when it comes to radically changing policing in this country?
Well, I think that what we're seeing are signs of transformation and change. And I welcome these signs. I'm hopeful. My heart beats and leaps with the fact that we're at least now have this on the front burner. The problem that I see is that the way the problem has been, issue has been framed, the way that the media has misframed the issue with all due respect, limits where we are now. So our challenge would be, in my opinion, to reconceptualize, rethink the criminal justice system as a whole. You see, what we're doing is we are focusing on police as if police are imagine in letters 10 feet high in concrete. Police are the problem. Well, I think the problem is systemic racism, and police are an effect rather than the cause. And so we witnessed a horrific killing in which a police officer stood on the neck or had his knees on the neck of a Black man for over 9 minutes as he was struggling to breathe. That to me is not just a problem of police brutality. There's an underlying narrative that traces back to slavery. I thought I was looking through a window and looking at a master brutalizing a slave. And I think that narrative, which comes from slavery. In slavery, when Blacks were whipped, they were whipped as a way of saying, you are a beast and I am a man. And that beast image of Black people still is latent in our society. I think it was latent in what we saw at George Floyd. Now, I think that those stereotypes and images have crystallized into statutes, laws, and policies. You see that in the so-called drug war, which is not a war on drugs. It has become a war on people living in the cities.
I want to get on the systemic racism thing. First, though, I want to ask you this on the verdict in the George Floyd case. Do you think that's an anomaly given the national coverage that it received?
I think historically, yes. I think what we're seeing is a difference, a sea change. A paradigm shift. So I think historically, police had a super presumption of innocence. And it didn't matter. Like we had a case in South Carolina where you saw the police officer on video plant a gun on the Black man in the first verdict of the jury was hung on for why we don't understand. There was a Michael Brown, three witnesses testified that his hands were up, and the police officer nonetheless acquitted. How is this possible? So there's not just a presumption of innocence against Black. There has been a presumption of innocence, super presumption of innocence for police. And I think what you witnessed in George Floyd is a shift. Now people are willing to listen more fairly than they ever were.
And you think about, about the jury. I wanted to know, because it's such a high profile case. And again, got so much attention. And I don't even want to say that it was attention. I think there was pressure. But how difficult do you think it was to find a jury that could do that work?
Well, I think that in today's climate, in a major city, you are going to be able to find people now who are at least willing with an open mind to see a Black person as a human being. Now, I think that the problem that you have is this was an extreme case. What will happen if the issues are a little bit more complex? Now, I think we're going to find that we haven't made the sea change that we think we have, because I don't think it has become easy or even necessarily likely that most police officers who commit acts of brutality will be held to answer.
But do you talk about that shift though within the system? Yes. Do you think that judges and attorneys are not taking the word of officers right away?
I think so. Yes, I think that there is far more. It's absolutely, there is a much more searching, much more thoughtful, much more careful approach to these issues. And I think that you're going to find that will translate into heightened accountability. So we're now in a new day in which I think it is possible to achieve accountability. But let me be clear. We will only achieve that if there is pressure from the outside, if there's a movement that is constantly pushing and demanding that accountability. So if we can maintain the pressure of activists, the pressure of academics, the pressures of everyone, and keep the spotlight, yes, I think you will see a change. But bear in mind that we still have a long way to go. This is the beginning of a 1,000-mile journey. We've taken the first step in the right historically, we took a step in the wrong direction. Now we're going in the right direction. We've taken a giant step, but we have a lot of other steps we have still to take.
You watched this whole thing play out, the entire trial to the very end. Can you remember another trial where you felt the same tension waiting for that verdict?
No. I think that this is something, this is a potentially transformative moment in American history. We're at a moment where we have a chance to change the criminal justice system. So people seem to think that we have a unitary criminal justice system. The system is not unitary. It is really almost like a dual system. It works one way, and I won't say that it's Black versus white, but in the inner city, you have a criminal justice system that works very differently from how it works in other areas. It's really as though the inner city has become a metaphor for race or the racial other. And so we see people and we have criminalized through the drug war, through the war on crime, policies where, for example, you arrest people for driving a car with windows that are too dark, or riding a bicycle without a driver, without a bicycle license. Those are kinds of things that almost only happen in Black communities. If you look at the way people are treated in terms of crack cocaine, Blacks and whites use cocaine in statistically identical rates, but it is overwhelmingly Blacks who are arrested. And you could go through all DUI, these are connected, because you see, every time a Black person has a confrontation with the police, that's a chance for that Black person to be shot to death.
Let me ask you about the systemic.
I'm sorry, please go on.
That's okay. I want to ask about the systemic racism and understand. You say the police are the effect. Put your finger on it. Where is it?
I think that there's no, so the problems are overdetermined, meaning there's not just one cause, but many. The biggest cause is that we have laws that are applied overwhelmingly an overwhelming disproportion to Black people, and the penalties are over. Let's just give us.
But why? Hold on a second, Donald. Why is it, for example, like if I get pulled over, and you get pulled over because you're a Black man. If you get pulled over, that the chances, statistics show you're more danger than I am. Why?
Yes.
We both broke the
presumption of dangerousness, a presumption of dangerousness, and a presumption of guilt. Those two things are two sides of one coin. People are afraid of Black men. They believed or listened to seen too many movies, Training Day, Boys in the Hood. Look at Netflix today at night. You'll see the urban thug movies. The stereotypes the way that Blacks have been stereotyped frightens people. I'm not that stereotype, but they see me as that stereotype.
Do you think police officers are afraid of Black men?
Absolutely. I had an uncle, and he was in his 50s. He says, shoot, I'm afraid of Black men, too. Jesse Jackson says, you know, I feel relieved walking in my Chicago neighborhood when I find it is a white man that is walking behind me. Yes, my goodness. Yes. People are afraid of Black men. They can't distinguish. It's like there's an image of a Black man as a beast. And that image has come down from slavery. And now it's the yesterday's beast is today's urban thug. I was walking in my own neighborhood, a gated community, expensive houses, expensive to me. I'm just a law professor. It might be to DJs, it won't be expensive. But, I was walking and I had some pants on that were a little too big. I lost weight. I have walking my dogs. All I'm doing is walking my dog. I come in the house within 5 minutes later. The police are at my door asking to see my ID to prove I have a right to be in my own house. Now, I was very dutiful. I went, found my license and handed it to him. But suppose I was irate. You see, so I think that yes, even I am seen by my neighbors. If I'm walking with saggy pants, potentially, I'm seen as a criminal or a thug. I'm not either of those. And I don't understand how I could be confused with that.
No,
I wear
no,
glasses. So I have gray hair, but it doesn't stop. So what you have to understand is...
As you're saying, there's this fear of Black men. That's why I wanted to just ask you about that. I just want to mention real quickly, again, I'm talking with constitutional law professor Donald M. Jones at the University of Miami, exploring criminal justice reform in Florida. This in the wake of the guilty verdict of Derek Chauvin in the murder of George Floyd. By the way, listen back to our panel conversation with Donald from last year about defunding the police by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. You can also find a link to his book, Dangerous Spaces, about racial profiling in modern day America. Donald, I just want to move only because of time into this. There were bills on police reform in Florida and talks of it on a federal level. How might this verdict help push this forward? Are you confident there's going to be real reform now?
Well, I think I'm confident there'll be real reform if the Black community and its allies push. But I do think that we've got to go further. I think that the bill now, I think, is still within the comfort zone of the establishment. They've talked about de-escalation. They've talked about training. They've talked about a number of things. We have to talk, I think, also about decriminalization. For example, we have thousands of people who are arrested for marijuana, most of them Black. Blacks represent a minority, but most of the people are arrested for marijuana, or a huge disproportionate number, are Black. Do we need those laws? Think of the Blacks who have been killed during arrests for marijuana. Do we need those laws? We have how many Blacks are arrested for jaywalking? And think of how was Michael Brown killed? He was arrested for jaywalking. Do we need those laws on jaywalking? We arrest Blacks in this county for driving with windows that are tinted too dark. Do we need arrests for? So if we can get rid of some of the laws, we create opportunities for Blacks to live
because there won't be. How about the again, going back to the systemic racism? Look, I'm not Black, so help me understand how we, you know, change that, because it seems like that is a societal problem. That's not something that we can just change rules.
It is a societal problem, and I think ultimately you're going to need massive investment in communities like Overtown, like Liberty City, the poor community is going to need massive investment.
But how do you change the cops? How do you change that issue with the police so that they don't?
I think that the most powerful thing you could do with police is what I would call community control. You could have people and the local community decide, well, for example, does a person who is our policeman have to live in this community? Should they carry a gun? Should their deployment be focused on arresting people because they're walking down the street with a bottle outside of a paper bag, or should be focused on violent crime? Give people in those local communities the power to control police. That would be the biggest thing you could do. The second step would be decriminalization. You reduce the friction between the police and you empower people. You know, there was a prosecutor in Maryland. She said that once they stopped arresting people for small amounts of crack cocaine, then the community became more prosperous. People were better able to get jobs. The community as a whole was able to function. So I think that the relationship between the police and those communities has been one of antagonism, where people see the police only as enemy. They see the law only as enemy. We can change that. If we change, for example, what laws we push for, we change that by giving people the power to control police. And we change that also by creating a culture of respect, where now we have a culture of stereotyping and disrespect.
And what do you think about HB1, the controversial law? Some call it the anti-riot law. Others have dubbed it the anti-protest law. But this
this frightens me. Why are we making laws to try to prevent people from expressing their views? I think we should be making laws which address the core root of the problem. People are protesting for a reason. We need to stop the killing. We need to stop people from dying. Now, until we do that, those protests are going to continue. The anti-riot law is not going to stop the protests. You stop the protests by getting to the root cause. Too many Black people are dying. And that is driven by a narrative, which is a presumption of guilt. And that narrative has crystallized in the statutes and laws, which are applied disproportionately. And police have become hyper-aggressive. We're in an era of hyper-aggressive policing in certain areas of our country. And we need to create a framework in which we have one system, which everyone's treated like a citizen. But to do that, we need to radically change our idea of what police do and what they do in Black communities. Give Black people the power to control their police. Get rid of laws like the law that says we're going to arrest people for marijuana, or they shouldn't even have the power to do that. So change those power relationships, you change society.
Have you spoken with Black officers in Miami-Dade about the issue of racism? And I'm wondering how, you know,
I tried to talk. I mean, I really tried. I was invited to a panel and they were mostly police officers. And the police officers treated the issues I was raising as separate from the enforcing the law. So they saw enforcing the law, arresting a so-called drug dealer, as that's their job. But to me, the Constitution is law. And the Constitution has, I say this with tears in my eyes, the Constitution has an equal protection clause. That is law in the United States. But in many communities, that equal protection clause, it's really as if it doesn't reach into the inner city. It should.
But do you
police
get a sense,
need to take that seriously.
But do you get a sense that there's any self-reflection within police departments to stop and look at the problem, this bigger problem, and how they're dealing with it?
I think it's a culture. I don't see the police individually. I think there are probably a lot of good people. It's a culture. And it's a culture that in the past has been a culture of impunity. That means that if the police did something like use force unnecessarily, kill someone unnecessarily, there is no cost. There was no price to pay. There was no indictment. There was no arrest. There wasn't even an investigation worthy of the name. Now, I think that that's the culture we need to change. And it's that culture which is driven by this presumption of guilt. We change that by changing the way those people, how much power those people have. You change that by investing in those communities. And you change that by giving the people power over their local police. So, I mean, I'm trying to say a lot in a short amount of time.
But to me, you know what? To me, it's still
relationships.
Yes, that's true, but it still sounds to me like until people can't get past this idea that if you can't look at a black man and not see a fellow man, a fellow human being, then
right.
I don't see how you fix this.
We have to change the narrative. But I think the most powerful way to change the narrative is change, for example, let's say that my community had good schools, that my community had jobs and opportunities, that the people in my community owned their own homes and owned businesses. The narrative will begin to change. If the people in those communities control the police, they decide who's going to patrol their neighborhoods, whether they have guns and so forth, change that power relationship. And then I think things will begin to change. Now, I do agree, it doesn't stop there. This is a societal process we must go through, but we have to try to identify some first steps.
Do you think the verdict in the murder trial of George Floyd, that starts to change that structure?
Yes. I think that is a hopeful sign. I think that this is, you know, we can all have hope. You know, he didn't die for, I mean, I would compare the George Floyd trial to the trial of Emmett Till. Emmett Till's death in 1950 in Money, Mississippi, the young 14-year-old boy who was lynched, that launched a civil rights movement. That civil rights movement was unfinished. I think that George Floyd's death has launched a second civil rights movement. And I think we've only just begun. I hope that people realize, though, that it's not the legislators by themselves who are going to make this happen. We have to create a context, a push that's going to compel them to rise to a level that we haven't gotten to before.
And I'm going to have to end it on that point. Great way to end it in a conversation that we'll just have to keep having because it's a very big issue. Donald M. Jones, again, constitutional professor at the University of Miami. Donald, always a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
All right. And again, you can read more of our coverage of criminal justice reform in this year's legislative session at WLRN.org. Still to come, live music coming back to South Florida in a big but safe way. The Bayfront Jazz Festival happening in Miami this weekend. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. It's been more than a year since many of us have gone to a large-scale event. I mean, think a baseball game or a festival. With more people getting vaccinated and the CDC's new guidance on the relative safety of outdoor activities, some pre-pandemic events are finding new life. The Bayfront Jazz Festival kicks off tomorrow in downtown Miami. The scaled-down event at Bayfront Park is strictly following COVID protocols. 1,500 attendees instead of the 10,000 capacity, spaced out seating, hand sanitizers, masks will be available to everyone. And for folks uncomfortable with the in-person event, there is a 4K live stream available. The lineup includes jazz and electronic musicians across the globe, from Dee Dee Bridgewater to Chucho Valdez to the Grammy-nominated producer and percussionist Mark Juliana. We spoke with Juliana this morning about the festival and his collaboration with the late David Bowie. You know, after a year in quarantine with musicians being pushed to live streaming performances, how does it feel to get back to an outdoor venue performing again in front of a live audience?
You know, I think I'll have a much better answer for you on Sunday morning after having had the experience. I can only imagine what it'll feel like, which is just great excitement and I just feel really privileged to have the opportunity to be on that stage and really share the stage with such incredible musicians.
I can only imagine for a performer like you, you haven't done this in a while, that there's an anticipation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even just having to wake up early tomorrow morning and get myself to the airport and go through that whole routine, which, you know, in a previous lifetime, pre-COVID, that was very, very routine and almost taken for granted. And now it's a very different relationship to, never mind being on the stage, but all the effort and energy that it takes of getting to the stage.
The music festival features such a variety of talented jazz artists. You got Dee Dee Bridgewater, Chucho Valdez. I wonder from you right now, how would you describe to somebody the state of jazz music right now? And how do you see, you know, your electronic music connecting with that?
It's a good question. I think for me, sometimes I get frustrated with, the over genrefication of music, if that's a word.
No, you just created it.
Yeah. So sometimes people are so quick to organize things into categories or genres, and in doing so, sometimes you actually tend to focus on what's different about things rather than what is similar about things. And not to, you know, make it too abstracted, but sometimes it feels like in life that happens more so than not, that we focus on the differences between things rather than the similarities. And if we can look more at the similarities, I feel like that's a way to unify and to bring things together. And I think a festival like this is a good example of, yes, maybe on paper, my music is quite different from Chucho Valdez, but, and I say this very humbly, I wouldn't typically put myself in the same sentence as him. He's a hero and a master. But, you know, to be on the same stage, that is the unifying element. And, you know, we're both drawing influences from similar places, whether it's obvious or not, you know, heavily relying on improvisation. It's just so that maybe the sound that'll be coming out of the speakers is quite different, but I'd like to say that the intention and the energy and the spirit behind it is coming from a similar place. So I think jazz, in a great way, the more we move forward, the bigger the umbrella has become, and the more different styles and different sounds can all hopefully, you know, happily live under this descriptive term.
You have been busy. You got your new music coming out, your album Beat Music, Beat Music, Beat Music. By the way, congrats, nominated for a Grammy. The album, very eclectic, mixing synth, xylophone, heavy drumming, vocal elements. Talk about your process in putting this album together with the group also known as Beat Music.
Yeah, this record, Beat Music, has been living in various forms for over 10 years, and it's what's really special for me is that it's comprised of really more of a collection of musicians rather than a specific lineup. There are a handful of guys that have been a part of the group over the years, and on this record it was important for me to include all of them and kind of present the Beat Music family, if you will, on the record. And compositionally, I challenged myself to just write. Usually my writing process is happening over time with projects in between, so it's rare that I might write a batch of music all in one go. But this record was that. It was it had that intention to start from scratch and really try to write 8, 9, 10 songs that might live, you know, might live together nicely on a record. And I was still living on the East Coast when we recorded that, and we recorded it in various places. So sometimes we'd be in a studio, sometimes we'd be at a friend's house tracking particular places. So it was not your traditional setup all in the same room and just play for a day and it's done. It was relying a little more on the production side of things. And I think that because of the influence of the electronic music and that world, this process lent itself to catering to that influence.
I'm speaking with Mark Giuliana. He's a percussionist and composer. Giuliana will be performing at the Bayfront Jazz Festival in Miami beginning tomorrow. The festival will be outdoors, socially distanced, has a limited number of seats, and will have masks and hand sanitizer readily available. You can find more details about the festival on our social media at WLRN Sundial. You know, you talk about the people you're going to be on stage with, you know, this upcoming performance, but you've had the chance to work with some incredible musicians. And I got to ask you about, you know, having the opportunity to work with the late, great David Bowie in his final album, Black Star. Tell me a little bit about what that experience is like for you, because, yeah, you can have a lot of fun being with someone you idolize, but it's going to make you a better performer.
Absolutely. You know, he was, I really can't say enough great things about him. It was, he was incredibly kind and generous and funny, and he really did encourage us to be ourselves inside the music. He was constantly pushing us to search for new musical possibilities. And in doing so, made us very comfortable. So I think it was just, a completely life-changing experience. He was so present, and we spent, over the course of 3 months, we spent about 1 week a month for 3 months. So really got to know him and hang out. And as you know, in the studio, it's almost more downtime than it is playing, you know, and, you know, you're setting up for the next thing, or you're waiting, or you're having lunch. So, of course, getting to make music with him was the honor of a lifetime, but also just getting to hang out and be silly and hear stories. It was really incredible, and I feel very, very lucky.
Look up here, I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be stolen.
You know, when you get to work with someone like that, I'm just wondering, as a drummer, to what extent are you just following that direction, you know, or you're able to incorporate your own, you know, your own lens into the music?
That's a good question. Usually it's one or the other. Usually, you know, I've been around people who have crystal clear vision. And because of that, they're asking you to do a very specific thing that is in line with their vision. Or I've been around people that are incredibly open to new ideas, but maybe that's because they don't have a clear vision themselves in that moment. And both paths are great. I'm happy to operate in either way, but with the case of David, it's the first time I've ever been around someone who had that crystal clear vision, but at the same time was open to new ideas. And those things seemingly contradict each other. But somehow he embodied both, and it made for a really exciting creative process.
Yeah. You know, I gotta tell you, Mark, it's interesting. I had these conversations with people from all kinds of industries about how life has changed. Do you feel safe, you know, in the touring environment? Do you feel that fans are safe?
I think it's going to be case by case, and depending on where you go, I feel safe. I'm, you know, I I'm fully vaccinated and I'm still happy to wear a mask and I'll, do all that stuff. And I'm happy to lean on the safe side of things. And because I feel like all I can do is be accountable for myself. And, I'm just excited to see things starting to happen. And then, I guess we all have our own view of things. But again, I knowing the precautions that I take and plan on taking, I do feel okay. I'm just anxious to get back to a bit of normalcy and when I say normalcy, just being able to play music with people in front of people.
That was Mark Giuliana. His group Beat Music will be performing at the Bayfront Park Jazz Festival this week. Go to our social media, WLRN Sundial, for more information. Don't forget, we're reading a new book for May. May Sundial Book Club pick is Of Women and Salt by Gabriela Garcia. So check it out. Find us on Facebook. Go to Sundial Book Club. If you're not a member, just ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. And tell us what you think of the book. We're going to talk with Gabriela in a couple of weeks. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. As always, stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.